Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Wherever and whenever you are in the world, thanks for tuning in and listening to the Scottish Field Podcast, released on Wednesday, the 10th of November, 2021. Thanks for joining us today. My name's Kenny Smith. I'm the web editor of Scottish Field. And over the next half hour or so, we'll be telling you all about our latest issue, our December issue, and we'll be learning about a Scottish icon. And today, I'm not alone. Why, who's that with me?
Hello, Kenny Smith. I see you. It's good to see you again. It's Rosie. I am the Chief Sub-Editor of Scottish Field. It is wonderful to see you again.
And it's wonderful to see you. And thank you for coming back on the podcast, because it's always a bit more fun when it's the two of us.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for having me. It's so nice.
And we've got a new issue to talk about, haven't we? Because, as ever, every month Scottish Field brings you the best of all things Scottish, with heritage, interiors, antiques, gardens, wildlife, motoring, whisky and country news, as well as interviews with famous Scots names. And we've certainly ticked all those boxes this month, haven't we?
Well remembered. I'm impressed that you managed to reel all of that off so beautifully, Kenny.
You're too kind.
Yeah, no, we have. We've got loads of things that we can look forward to introducing our readers to this month. And as you say, it's the Christmas special. So we have everything that you need for the festive season ahead, including my favourite thing, as always, food.
Mm-hmm. And we've got somebody who's, I suppose you could say, he's fairly well known, giving us some ideas for Christmas this year.
I suppose you could say that. Mr. Jamie Oliver himself has given us his ultimate Christmas recipes. Although, because this year they are saying that there may well be a shortage of turkeys. Can you believe that? He's given us some alternative recipes. Mm. A dukkah roast chicken with warm pomegranate gravy dressing. That sounds pretty good, actually, doesn't it?
And I love pomegranates.
Yeah, and they're like little crown jewels on top of anything. So it's a perfect thing for Christmas time. What do you have around the Christmas table at your house?
Well, this is really bizarre, because I only discovered the year before she passed away that my mum didn't like prawns, because I'd always assumed that she had, but I'd never noticed this. So for my starter at Christmas dinner, I always like my prawn cocktail. However, I do have a penchant for smoked salmon and cream cheese on an Nairn's oat cake, because I am of the Nairn's oat cake family. And that's my preferred starter. Then a turkey. And bizarrely enough, I've actually been looking for turkey and I can't find an extra large crown anywhere at the moment over here in East Kilbride. So that's a bit annoying. So yes, this chicken from Jamie Oliver may well be getting bunged in my oven.
The thing that always has to be in our Christmas stocking, obviously, is a chocolate orange Jamie has provided us with. So generously, it is a chocolate orange creme brulee. Doesn't that sound interesting?
Yep. Got to have a chocolate orange. Christmas isn't Christmas without a chocolate orange. Got to have at least the original chocolate orange. And if there's any variations, whether it's with popping candy, white chocolate, yeah, I'll have those quite happily, or mint. But no, you really do need to have the original chocolate orange. That is an absolute must. And if I don't get one, Christmas is cancelled.
It's cancelled. It's a lump of coal for anyone who doesn't get his chocolate orange.
Exactly.
Oh, that's good. So we've got loads of gift ideas this year, haven't we, in our December issue? Pages and pages of gift guides, which is looking fabulous.
Yes, there's so much there, because we were looking through them last week when we were in just finishing off the issue and doing the final production. Could not believe just how much there's there. An absolute plethora of wonderful gifts for him and for her and anyone else, really, any special people in your life. There's just such a variety of trinkets you can buy. You can buy some jewellery. Fabulous places to go and stay as well, and genuinely some stuff that will take your breath away, because there are some incredible places to go and stay that you wouldn't really have thought of and just think, oh. So yes, hugely recommend our gift guide. What caught your eye?
Do you know what always appeals to me is when our four-legged friends aren't left out, which there are all manner of dog beds, luxury dog beds, my goodness, Berkeley dog beds, lazy paws. They are going to have a wonderful Christmas if this is anything to go by. So Donald, the family Labrador, he will not be left out and he'll be delighted, I'm sure.
Fantastic. Unfortunately, I only have a cat and my Nemo doesn't tend to like proper beds. He actually gets excited when he sees the Amazon deliveries coming, because he thinks, oh, it's a new box to climb in. Absolutely true. He gets excited when he sees the guy coming down the path, because he knows that's a new temporary bed for him. So what you going to do?
Have all the wrappers and all the boxes to enjoy that till his heart is content, little Nemo.
Oh, he'll love it. He'll be more than happy with that. And it's just such a packed issue. And there's some wonderful other Christmassy related features as well, including our interior this month. What a fabulous house that is.
Yeah. How do you fancy a bright pink sofa?
It's not quite my colour. It doesn't go with my eyes.
No, maybe not. Maybe not. But no, it looks fabulous. And they've decked out the house. I mean, it's like a grotto. It looks amazing. I need to get them round to my flat this year to help me with decorations. No, it looks wonderful. And it's in Corversal House, it's called. Lovely couple that own it. And our lady who does the writing every month for our interiors, Nicola Hunter, has been round to visit them. And yeah, it went from an unloved, dilapidated old building and has evolved into a magical family home that's full of colour.
Something I always enjoy are our wildlife features. And there's one with a slight difference this month, aren't there, with the river perils. Who'd have thought such things were possible in Scotland?
I know. And these wonderful little jewels are in peril, as it says in our whoever it was that came up with that one, kudos to them, pearls in peril. Yeah, it's a really interesting one. And there's lots of interesting historic detail in there as well. And Rick Wilson, who's written about it, he speaks to a few people who have a lot more knowledge about the pre-1998 days when pearl fishers would sell all shapes and sizes of these pearls around Scotland's jewellers. So, yeah, really, really interesting. Who'd have known, as you say?
Yeah, not something I expected at all. It's something I didn't know of whatsoever. So, yes, definitely another insightful read. And of course, mentioned earlier that we have famous Scots names, and you spoke to somebody who was my dad's hero, especially back in 1990 on the rugby field. So tell us who you spoke to for our Credo column.
Oh, I did. I spoke with Gavin Hastings. What a wonderful rugby player. Was it 61 caps that he won for Scotland? Mm-hmm. Close to it anyway. So yes, we talked obviously about his rugby career, and we talked about his new book, which is called Legacy of the Lions. Mm-hmm. He went to the Bailey Gifford Borders Book Festival to talk all about it. But he was also just chatting away about people that he wouldn't mind being stuck in a lift with, where he might enjoy a dram. So yeah, we covered lots of topics. He's a wonderful man.
Yes, and see, my first ever Scotland rugby international came in 1990, the year of the Grand Slam. So I went to the France game and then went to the England game with my dad at Murrayfield, the old Murrayfield, and got amazing memories. And of course, he was on the field, and it was just, what a buzz. So I always think of him and I smile, because I've never seen my dad that happy. So yes, that was happy memories, happy day.
And of course, you, Kenny, have written a piece as well for this month's magazine. Can you tell us all about that, please?
I have indeed. As today is the 10th of November, and 150 years ago today, four of the most famous words reputed to have been said between two people are allegedly uttered. Dr. Livingston, I presume. When American journalist Henry Morton Stanley encountered Dr. David Livingston in Africa, as Livingston had been missing for a few years during his missionary work, and he was found by the journalist. And it's a story that, of course, I think everybody is well aware of, and the fact that Livingston was, you know, did so much to fight against the slave trade and during his years in Africa. And it was quite a fascinating story, because I grew up in Cambuslang, which is, what, 5-6 miles away from where Livingston was born in Blantyre. And I went along to the recently reopened David Livingston Birthplace Museum and had a look around there and heard the story for myself and saw how it's changed. Because when I was a wee boy, this was the traditional place you went on a Sunday school trip, due to the fact there was quite a, in fact, Livingston was a missionary. So there was that element of faith in there. And it was pretty much that you'd always see at least one Sunday school party there every week.
Yeah.
It was quite a, you know, quite a place. And having gone back, it's quite incredible how they've revamped it. And of course, in the post, you know, Black Lives Matter and George Floyd, everything, the timing of it was, it was coincidental, because it's been, you know, reevaluating things that Livingston did. And it does show that he was very much, you know, an abolitionist, wanted to fight against the slave trade. But it also does admit that latterly, and during his later years, he did get some help from people who did have slaves to help him on his exhibitions. I think he took supplies from them. So it's not painting him in an evangelical way at all. It's very much, you know, it's reevaluating and looking at the fact that he did do a lot of good work. And there's a lot of work been done to try and identify the people who were on his parties, and they've done their best with it. It's really, really fascinating, and I would hugely recommend it if anyone is in the area to pop by and have a visit.
Yeah, because you're mentioning the David Livingston Birthplace Museum, which I think you've written in your piece, had a £9.1 million revamp.
Yeah.
And you spoke with a chap, Grant McKenzie, the interim director.
I did indeed. In fact, why don't we hear from him now?
Oh, I would love to, yes. And let's get some insight into Dr. Livingston's life. Lovely.
We presume.
We presume indeed.
My name's Grant McKenzie, and I'm interim director for the David Livingston Birthplace.
There's a lot more to David Livingston than just four words.
Yes.
As a lot of people seem to think. If you could maybe explain a wee bit more about why he's so important.
Yeah, I mean, the Dr. Livingston, I presume, phrase is one that didn't necessarily take place. However, as you say, it's probably what Livingston's best known for. Livingston is famous for, you know, he was brought up here in Blantyre. The building we are in is a former mill, and he, you know, self-educated himself here. He then worked in the mill at the same time, but also walked to Glasgow, so the 8 miles to Anderson College. He walked there and back in the day, and so he was very much self-taught. So I think locally he's known for being, you know, someone to look up to, someone inspiring, who had international fame. His explorations in Africa and his missionary work in Africa was the reason he became famous. I think he wasn't a massively successful missionary, so he only converted one person. So interesting to be famous for something that actually you potentially weren't massively successful at. But I think one of the main things that actually is Livingston's sort of enduring legacy is actually the fact that for a number of years he was missing. So, you know, the international press really took hold of the story, and when Henry Morton Stanley found him with the famous words, Dr. Livingston, I presume, that was hugely significant, and you know, was known internationally and reported internationally. So I think Livingston's appeal is that he then had an international appeal, and you know, he did you know, some very positive things about discovering, you know, terrain of Africa, exploring that area. So he did, his later work kind of fed into potentially the colonisation of some of the African countries. So even though that's not what he directly was trying to achieve, I think his impact was kind of longer lasting.
We know the things that he's famous for finding, like the Victoria Falls.
Yeah.
But what were the other things that he came across in his travels?
So, just correct you on that one, that first European to find, to discover the Victoria Falls. So we're kind of making that very, very clear. I mean, he was famous for travelling up the Zambezi, trying to find the source of the Nile. If you look at his expeditions, my description of it would be a drunk man coming home, because he is all over the place and he's back and forth. And obviously, you know, he was relying quite heavily on the Africans who were travelling with him. So his crew that came with him were absolutely vital in his expedition. So there's perhaps a perception that Livingston was a sort of lone explorer and these kind of things, but he had a big crew round him. And for example, his wife Mary Livingston, when he first came to Southern Africa, she could speak the local languages, he couldn't. So his wife helped translate things for him, and his crew did an awful lot for him as well. And this is one of the sort of stories that we're not rewriting his story in any way, we are very much recontextualizing it. So since this museum, the last iteration of it was produced, there's been a lot more research on Livingston, and so we have more information on people like his crew, Sicelli, Chuma, who were all, you know, for example, some of them actually took his body back
to Westminster. So once he died, his heart was actually buried under a tree in Zambia, and then his companions took his body to the west coast of Africa, and then he went on to Westminster. So it's kind of lots of different stories about Livingstone and lots of different aspects. You know, as I said, he was a doctor, he was really interested in geology, and he, you know, wrote an awful lot, and so we got, you know, his journals with sometimes doodles on them and things like that. So he produced a lot of material, and that then, you know, informed, I suppose, what the UK or, you know, some of the colonial powers' impression of Africa was, because he was the first Western person to actually discover lots of these areas. Yeah, the Western and the European bits are really significant in the way we are ensuring that we're telling the story now, actually.
Because obviously there's been an awful lot of things being recontextualized, particularly over the last 18 months or so.
Yeah, basically, you're right, the past 18 months changed things, because obviously Black Lives Matter and changed the discussions that museums and heritage institutions were having about these kind of topics. We've been working on this project for 4 years, and so we have been continually looking at Livingstone's story, trying to look at it from multiple perspectives, so that, you know, the perception, as I said, of Livingstone being a lone explorer is one that kind of sticks in the head and was kind of the well-known one, but we've spent a lot of time looking into the other individuals, if the information's available. I mean, one of the things that we have found is that because it is written from Livingstone's perspective, you're very much getting his view and his subjective view on the travels and the expeditions, and there's less written about the other people. And sometimes we have people in the crew, for example, who we don't know the names of at all. And so it's that kind of information we've been looking at. But we, you know, for example, we have in our new exhibition an interactive which is called Who's Who, and basically you're identifying who went on which expedition with them, and there's a number of them that don't have any names or photographs, and that just shows you that these people were not written into history. We've been looking into this for 3 years, so actually when Black Lives Matter sort of happened last year, we've been spending a lot of time thinking about it and discussing it and, you know, making sure that we were using appropriate terminology to describe people. One thing that they were all the people were, as I said, weren't really named, or they were just described as, you know, the men or the Africans. So we've been trying to make sure that they actually have names associated with them if we can find them. So we've been spending a lot of time doing all that already. And so when Black Lives Matter happened and there was more discussions going on about that, we actually were fairly far down the line in that. I'm not saying we've got everything perfect, and it is very much we are starting this process, but had an impact, and a positive impact probably for us, that allowed us to seek other funding to probably progress more activities around sort of Black history, how it links with Scottish history as well, how slavery has an impact on that as well. But it didn't have probably as significant an impact as it may have had for other places, because we were actually part way down that journey. And the project originally was supposed to take 18 months. It's 4 years later, and pandemics don't help with doing projects like that. The building itself was, you know, was workers' cottages, was a tenement, so it was part of the mill, the Blantyre Mill, and, you know, it would have been built fairly cheaply there. And so when we came to restore the building, there was very simple things like brickwork wasn't as you would expect it to be, and so we had to do probably a lot more remedial work on the building than we hoped.
The fact that we've got this, his legacy is absolutely massive. The fact that his name is known throughout the world, and of course, so it's been commemorated here. So can you tell us a bit about the history of obviously being an NTS property before?
Yeah, so Trust, David Livingstone Trust, was actually set up in 1929, and it was set up to keep the birthplace where he was actually born, so the room where David Livingstone was born and lived with the other five members of his family is a room you can come and see when you visit the museum. We largely haven't changed that since the previous exhibition. The reason that actually the room was still intact, and this is the only part of the mill that still exists, was the story is that an old lady started charging people to go up and visit the birthplace room, and so she kind of preserved it in a certain state, and from there it was decided that set up a trust to preserve it, you know, for future generations. The Church of Scotland and, as I mentioned, Sunday schools were all involved in helping fund that. And from there, that's when the trust was set up. And then sort of in the 70s, 80s, National Trust for Scotland had an operating licence for it. So they managed the building for the trust. But the building itself was, you know, I don't know the last time you were here, but certainly in need of some love and repair. The need for funding to restore the building was quite easy to persuade funders on that bit of it, because it was, the building was very damp, so the outside of the building would originally have lime render on it, and what they had done is put some concrete render on it, which basically allowed the damp to retain in the building. So the whole building was, you know, in a bad condition at that point. And so what we've done is restore the lime render and to sort of going back to its original condition. And also the exhibition itself was very much of its era. I would say it would probably be fair to describe it as it was hero worshipping Livingston. And as with anyone, there's good and bad on both sides of these things. So, you know, Livingston was a proactive abolitionist, so he campaigned to end the slave trade, and, you know, he did have an impact on what the UK Parliament did there. However, on his last expeditions, when he really got into trouble and he didn't have much of a crew, his supplies were very short, he took supplies from some of the slave traders. So there's a sort of contradiction in some of Livingston's story. But for me, and I think we find out that makes it all more interesting, actually, you know, it kind of shows that, and that's why we moved the exhibition narrative on from that, to kind of include lots of different people's perspectives.
Interesting. That's good. So what can you say about what else we can see?
What can you say in the exhibition? So it's quite significantly different than the previous exhibition. We're very much taking a different approach, as I said. One of the key things that was in the museum previously was the Pilkin Jackson sculptures. So they're 8 sculptures which basically depict different periods in Livingston's life. They are very much of their time, so they kind of very much Livingston looking down on Africans, or him at the forefront and them in the background. So that's an interpretation of Livingston's story, but very much of its time. We wouldn't change that. We have restored them, so you know they are quite unique and unusual in as sculptures themselves. But what we've done with that is actually we have a bit at the end of the exhibition which is called Legacy, and it's basically looking at Livingston's legacy. So looking at that on both whether that's good or bad. The rest of the exhibition is a chronological story, so birth to death. This part of the exhibition is very much looking at, so what was the actual impact? And we've tried to make sure we're kind of reflecting contemporary Africa a wee bit more on that. So we have a number of videos which are speaking to people who have a knowledge of Livingston in, you know, Botswana, Zambia, Malawi, but also Scotland and the UK, and just getting different perspectives on, you know, what was his actual impact. The other thing with Pilkin Jackson sculptures is we have actually brought them to life. So we have an animation, and as described, the sculptures, there's Livingston at the front, there is his crew at the back, or even his wife at the back of some of these things. And basically they're actually going to come to life and start telling their story and telling it from their perspective, rather than Livingston's perspective. And we've worked with Petina Gapa, who's a Zimbabwean novelist who wrote a book about basically about Livingston's companions taking his body back. And so we're trying to do sort of quite creative things in how we're telling his story. We have a sculpture of the lion out in the park. We now have a statue inside, which is kind of kid-friendly, but maybe bordering slightly on the scary. We're still to find out how that works when the kids come in. And the rest of it is really separated into the different periods of Livingston's life. But it's very visually different and visually striking, much more immersive than it was previously. We have about 22 interactives for kids of all ages. Some of them are more challenging than others. I'm still trying out how to work some of them, but you know, we're trying to broaden it out so we can appeal to, you know, a wider audience. Before the museum shut, the visitor numbers were sort of below 10,000. So his appeal had dwindled. And whether that was to do with, you know, the building needing refurbishment, the site perhaps. But I think it also links to perhaps UK perceptions of Livingston as a missionary and, you know, the decline in attendance in churches and religion. He was very associated with that element. And that's something we're very much still telling as part of the story. But I think our visitor numbers had sort of dwindled. He kind of had more of a, he still does potentially still have more of an impact internationally than he maybe does in the UK. So we're obviously trying to, you know, well, we're recontextualising the story to try and appeal to wider audiences, because his story can tell lots of different things. You know, he was self-taught, he cared about the environment. So some of the things that he did are kind of quite well ahead of the time, actually. And so, you know, there are very positive things to tell about Livingston's story. And, you know, he was very clearly an extremely determined man to go on these exhibitions. Currently would be challenging, but if you think when he actually did it, and, you know, he foolhardy or not, continued on journeys that other people wouldn't have done, I think, actually, you would have, if you were doing a risk assessment on it, you would have thought, this isn't really worth it, to be honest, actually. But that's what makes him, I think, so appealing as well, actually, is, you know, he was an interesting leader. He had more respect for the Africans in his crew. The Europeans, he was extremely competitive with, and very dismissive of a lot of them as well, actually. So he wasn't actually a great leader in that way, but I think his sole mind, single-mindedness and determination, you know, is something that people find appealing, and I think that's why his story is still being told.
Well, there we go. Fascinating, absolutely fascinating, the fact that Stanley's journal still exists. And talking of things you can read, how's that for a seamless link? Let's talk about our book reviews this month. We've got, normally we'd have 2 pages worth, but this issue we've got 20 books reviewed over 4 pages.
Yeah, quite a lot of reading to be cracking on with. And again, you know, there's one standout book to me, which I would love to mention. It's Peter Salkin's book. And for anyone who doesn't know who Peter Salkins is, he is the great British Bake Off superstar from Edinburgh. And he came away with the title, which is amazing. Was it last year or the year before?
It was last year. It's 2020, yep.
Last year. That's incredible. And he's so young and he's come on so, so well. But this is his new recipe book. And it just has so much of his personality comes through in it, as well as the amazing recipes that all of us need to try. Mm-hmm. Morag had the joy of reading all about it. I can't remember what she said was her favourite recipe, but I think also one of the biggest things in his book was that you can make so many of the recipes gluten-free, because his brother is completely gluten-free.
Yeah.
So that's quite cool, isn't it?
It is indeed. Somebody who I would love to chat to, because he came across just as an absolute gent on the show last year, mature way beyond his years, and such a pleasant young chap. Have you ever met him?
I haven't met him in person. I've interviewed him, but no, I would love to get the chance to say hello. He just seems such a cheery chappy, doesn't he?
He does, just very upbeat.
He burns off all the calories, apparently, that he bakes by badminton.
That's,
I think,
right.
He's a very keen badminton player. Maybe that's the key to success. Maybe if I did more badminton.
It sounds good, because I think there's plenty more Christmas present ideas in there as well, with all these books. A good mixture of stuff for everyone there. There's novels, there's factual books, and of course Peter's book as well. So what did you say it was called?
Peter Bakes. It's called Peter Bakes.
Nice and simple. I won't forget that one.
Yeah, it was published by Black and White, and the RRP is £20. So nice little stocking filler for many people's Christmases this year, I think.
It most definitely is. Most definitely is. There's so much in there that we're still not talked about. It's quite hard to pick out one more highlight that we can mention, as all our regular columnists are there, with Fiona Armstrong and Guy Grieve, Alexandra McCall-Smith and Blair Bowman and his whiskey. So yes, this is all in our December issue, all this and much, much more, which will highlight the best places in Scotland, with food, drink, places to stay, and amazing items to purchase in her gift guide, as we said. And it's all priced £4.75. And if you want to order a copy, you can pop onto her website and go to www.scottishfield.co.uk/subscriptions. And talking of things online, you can follow us on our social media. You can find us on Twitter at www.twitter.com/Scottish Field.
And on Instagram, you can follow us at Scottish Field Mag. That's M-A-G. And you can send us all your beautiful pictures of Scotland and everything. We look forward to seeing them.
Absolutely. And we've also got our Facebook page, which is at www.facebook.com/Scottish Field. So please do pop by and like our page. And of course, mustn't forget to mention our website, which is now fully up to speed with daily properties, daily books, and lots of food, whiskey, cultural, and news from schools around the country. And you can get that at www.scottishfield.co.uk, where you'll find unique content that doesn't appear in the magazine. And you can also purchase the magazine through the site, as we mentioned earlier, in physical and digital formats. That's all we've got time for this week. Rosie, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you, Kenny. I hope you have a wonderful afternoon and lovely chatting with you, as always.
Same with you, Rosie. We'll see you soon and we'll be back next week with another episode. Thanks for listening. Be seeing you.